This podcast was recorded at Hartford Street Zen Center, Isanji, in San Francisco. Please help support our temple by making a donation at hscc.org.
Neil mentioned that I'm from Santa Cruz, and I also am from Arcata Zen Group in Northern California, Humboldt County. I teach in both places. It's a little strange to live in two places so distant from one another, with a long outdoor hallway. And I've just been this morning, or yesterday afternoon and evening, this morning, I was at Green Gulch Farm in Marin County, visiting in Dokusan with Linda Ruth Cutts, and then also attending service in Zazen there this morning. And I realized upon arriving that I hadn't actually slept in that place for 32 years. The last time was in 1985. I visited there often, but I come and go. So it was a pleasure to sleep there and have the chance to enjoy Zazen and service in the morning with the whole community. The rest of the community was going to stay this morning and sit through the day, sit Zazen through the day, alternating, sitting and walking, a couple of meals here and there. And also Santa Cruz Zen Center is in retreat this weekend. Lots of Zazen going on. So I'd like to talk today about what Neil mentioned, actually. I think that was your voice this morning. During Zazen, sitting, doing nothing. What is this thing that we're doing? Doing nothing. And as a way to kind of meander into that topic, I thought I would bring to you this work that I have been doing internally that is working with translations. It's not so easy to translate the deepest intent of the Asian languages into English. As I understand it, each character has within it multiple interpretations, and also a variety of vocabulary from English that could be chosen to understand that interpretation. And the character itself, the stroke order, the content of the character itself has some nuance to it that probably is not translatable. So as an example, working with translation, this one that we just now chanted, an unsurpassed, penetrating, and perfect Dharma. It's pretty consistent in the California temples that I visit. And I went onto the Soto Shu website. The Soto Shu is the lineage of Soto Zen in America, Soto Zen everywhere, and the English versions are what they recommend to be used. And if you're ever curious, partly I've mentioned websites in order that you become curious. If you're ever curious, you can go on yourself and Soto Shu website, and there are all of the chants that we do here in multiple languages, not just the European languages that we might expect, but many languages. So here's in English what we just did, an unsurpassed, penetrating, and perfect Dharma. The Soto Shu version of that is the unsurpassed, profound, and wondrous Dharma. That's not so different. Profound, penetrating, it's about the same. And next line is rarely met with even in 100,000 million kapas. That's just the same as what we do. So I'm guessing that there's very little ambiguity in the characters for numbers. Numbers are just numbers. And now this one. We say, having it to see and listen to remember and accept. And their version, now we can see it and hear it accept and maintain it. Not so different, but remember and maintain, just a little different, subtle. There's some activity involved in maintaining. Some effort involved in maintaining. And here we say, I vow to taste the truth of the Tathagata's words. And in some places, it becomes quite strong. I vow, you know, with the emphasis on the I. And Catherine, my teacher, emphasized, and so do I now, the vow part. I vow. And I've heard Blanche, when she was still alive, speak about it as vowing. Take out the I completely. So the Sotoshu version, this is one that has touched me. Rather than I vow, we say, may we unfold the meaning of the Tathagata's truth. That's subtly but powerfully different. There's a collective nature in this one that's not present in the one that we typically use. May we unfold the meaning. And not just the Tathagata's words, but the Tathagata's truth, as expressed perhaps even beyond what we might think in words. So even these four lines gives us a little hint about how challenging it might be to work with translation. So as a little preamble, I think, to the sitting doing nothing, I'd like to talk about it in this context. We have what we call, perhaps, in some places called the perfections, and I prefer the word paramitas, actually. It's because in the Western world we get goofed up with the word perfection. We think that it means unflawed or something, you know. So I like to avoid the perfections and rather use the paramita word. So there are a list of sometimes considered six of these paramitas, and it begins, as you have on the back wall here, with generosity. And this doesn't simply mean the generosity of giving money or material goods. It's the generosity of spirit. It's kind of operating in life with an open and generous heart that's always looking for inclusivity. So the perfection of wisdom is the perfection of the final paramita. Begins with generosity and goes into ethical behavior. Then patience, beginning our activity with effort. Sometimes this is called joyful effort, or sometimes it's called enthusiastic perseverance. Enthusiastic, perhaps better, because we don't necessarily have to be joyful to bring some determination and enthusiasm to an activity. So effort, and then concentration, which can be understood as focus or clarity of mind. And then the last of these is wisdom. And we might think that it culminates in wisdom, but actually each of the paramitas is embedded in each other paramita. They're a collective. So the wisdom is not necessarily a culmination. However, I'm going to encourage you toward another website, the San Francisco Zen Center website, that has these paramitas very clearly spelled out. And this is what it says about the wisdom. With the perfection of wisdom, we develop the ability to recognize the truth behind the temporary display of all appearances. The truth behind the temporary display of all appearances. That's a very clever way of embodying, I dare say, the entirety of the Buddha's teaching in one sentence. It's quite strong. not to deny appearances, but to recognize them as temporary and interact with them as temporary. So this perfection of wisdom, according to the San Francisco Zen Center website, is the result of contemplation and meditation. And rightly understanding the nature of reality. So this is meant to be an encouragement to stay with this zazen that we do, that is sitting and doing nothing. There's a wonderful teaching by our Dharma leader from the 1200s named Dogen, and that teaching is called the Fukan Zazengi. It is universal recommendations for zazen, or universal instruction for zazen. And as I understand it from having studied now, you can do this too. You can find a variety of translations. I tend to go with 3 or 5 and physically lay them side by side and compare them line by line. What might the original text have been getting at if this is what the English approximation is? So the Fukan Zazengi, the universal recommendation for zazen, in part at least, is put your body this way. Put your right foot on your left thigh and your left foot on your right thigh and establish some stability. Sit upright, nose and chin in line with the navel, ears in line with the shoulders. So many of us in the West are not accustomed so much to sitting on the floor, not so easy to get the right foot on the left thigh and so on. So another way to say this is stabilize your lower body. Whatever you need to do to stabilize your lower body, get settled. And now in zazen instruction in the West, many people add not just your nose and chin in line with your navel, but your ears in line with your shoulders and your shoulders in line with your hips. Many of us are accustomed to leaning forward, looking at a computer screen much of the day. And so I personally have to be reminded to get myself tipped, what feels somewhat tipped backwards, but actually it's just upright. So, ears in line with the shoulders, shoulders in line with the hips, and put your hands in the posture that you know, tip of the tongue up against the roof of the mouth. Now we have the physical posture, the stability, and there is some teaching in the Fukan Zazengi about the mind, what, how to work with the mind. From what I understand, this particular teaching Dogen wrote in around the year 1231, but it's obvious that it has influences from about 400 or 500 years prior from China. And there are multiple versions of the Fukan Zazengi, so it's clear that Dogen edited and refined this over his lifetime. I am assuming it's more and more refined, better, more clear. No one would edit and revise to make it worse. Let's see how obscure I can make this for you. So, edit and refine over his lifetime. Multiple versions, and in many ways all saying the same thing. Settle your body down and experience what you're experiencing. There is this line in it that sometimes confuses people. There are multiple versions of this particular line in translation. The one we use in Santa Cruz sounds like this in this particular chunk. It starts with, in general, in this world and others, it's the character of this school pervades. And then, overall prevails the character of the school, which is simply devotion to sitting, total engagement in immobile sitting. It's pretty straightforward. And then it goes on. Although it is said that there are as many minds as there are persons, still they all negotiate the way solely in Zazen. Here's one of the ways I work with translation. That particular line is clear, and it, for me personally, it kind of falls flat. So I'm looking for what else has a translator done with that? And here's what I found. This one. No, this one. Starts out the same, in general, in our world and others, all equally hold the Buddha seal. While each expresses its own style, they are all simply devoted to sitting. And this is the line that gets me, this next chunk. I've had contact recently with a Dharma teacher named Joanna Macy, maybe you know of her. And she talks about this experience that occurred for me as being a popped kernel of corn. What was inside is now the outside, turned inside out. So this particular line, rather than total engagement in immobile sitting, totally blocked in resolute stability. I love that. And so in English, we can understand blocked in a variety of ways. Now we're becoming interpretive, right? Blocked can mean inhibited, or there's some obstacle or there's some hindrance. And I understand in this moment for this place, this kind of blocked meaning stable, blocked, like a block of stone, right? Just here, completely blocked. And then the resolute stability, we could call the stability of the physical posture, or we could also start now engaging with the activity of the mind, not separate from the posture. And now the word resolute. I actually had to look this one up to be able to be accurate. And as it turns out, there are about 21 definitions of resolute or resolve. So the typical, we would understand it this way, easy, to come to a definite or earnest decision about, to resolve, that's easy, to determine to do something, or to deal with a question conclusively, to settle, to solve. That all sounds quite familiar. There's a way to use it as a noun, as in, if one has resolve, one has a firmness of purpose or intent, some kind of determination. And there's a way to use it as an adjective, when one might take resolute action, or, in this case, resolute stability. Here's the definition of resolve that really lit me up. In music, to progress from dissonance to consonance. When a piece of music moves from dissonance to consonance, it is said that it is resolved. When I work then with totally blocked in resolute stability, I have this intuition that it's talking about this kind of resolve, moving from our own perhaps personal or collective dissonance into consonance. Consonance can kind of give the impression that we're looking for always something mellow, you know, always something kind of chill. In Arcata, the town up north, there's actually a store named Zen that sells mellow stuff. It's all about being mellow. So I think this is a little bit of a divergence from what we're actually talking about in Zen. In seated meditation, if I tell the truth, and I will tell the truth now, my zazen is not necessarily mellow, you know. I'm agitated, or I'm, grinding on something. It could be simple something. My mind is busy working on tomorrow's grocery list, or thinking what I might have told my mom before she died, or I'm busy building the 2018 calendar. You know, my mind is busy grinding on something active. And this is not necessarily mellow, you know, it's agitating. And then on the personal level, when we're working with our own suffering, it's hard to stay seated and agitated by what might be revealing itself within. Not mellow. However, this resolute stability and becoming practiced at resolute stability allows us to find some clarity, perhaps is a word, even while the mind is busy grinding on something. There is something else occurring that is body-based. There's some kind of settling that's going on. And from my point of view, our entire Zen Buddhism is a practice that needs to be experienced. It's not a concept. It's not an idea. It's not something we can intellectualize. The Fukan Zazengi gets at some of this, but it doesn't cover all of Zen. It just begins to name what the Zen experience is. The agitation was also demonstrated to us, you know, by Buddha's life, the way in which I believe he skillfully worked with agitation in his own life. For example, you know, we often see Buddha figures in a meditative posture. Often on the altar, there's one in meditation. But there are also other Buddha figures. You probably have seen them, maybe perhaps not even recognizing what you're seeing. There is sometimes a Buddha figure that has the fingers like any person would be, and they're counting. Have you seen that one? So what that figure is giving us, a moment in the Buddha's life when the Buddha is teaching the Four Noble Truths, the first teaching that he offered to five people. And any person would be counting on their fingers this way. The first noble truth, that there is out of balanceness sometimes in this span of life between what we call birth and what we call death. Sometimes that's translated as there is suffering. I prefer to use the word out of balanceness. And then the second noble truth, you've heard it, I'm sure, many times. The cause of this out of balanceness is clinging. As if things are permanent, we expect them to be permanent. We cling to them, wanting them to be permanent, and they're not. So the whole teaching of impermanence is embedded in that one. And the third noble truth, the way to end the out-of-balanceness is to end clinging. This is straightforward, logical. And then the Buddha, in his compassion, offered us the fourth of the noble truths. The way to end clinging is to follow the Noble Eightfold Path, and gave very specific behavior about how to end our clinging. I don't know why I started talking about hand posture. Oh, because of mellow. You know, the Buddha's not always, Buddha's life was not always mellow. The hand posture. Here's where my mind was going. I might as well tell you the whole story. There's another hand posture in the Buddha figures that we see, that is the right hand raised like this. And in Buddha's lifetime, he had a family, of course, and one of his family members was a cousin named Devadatta. That Devadatta was a disciple of the Buddha for a while, and then became at some point quite competitive and decided that he wanted to end the Buddha's life. And tried three times and failed three times. The first time, he hired somebody to kill the Buddha, and it didn't work. No exact details about it. Hired someone. And the second time, Devadatta made a huge elephant drunk and sent that elephant charging at the Buddha. And the Buddha, from a seated posture, raised his right hand and pacified the elephant. And it is said, we don't know about legends like this, it is said that not only did that elephant stop and not charge, but became a devoted follower of the Buddha. In case you're curious, there was a third attempt on Buddha's life by Devadatta himself, and sent a pile of rocks tumbling down a mountainside into the Buddha's path. That also didn't kill him. It hurt him, but it didn't kill him. Anyway, if we have this idea that our practice is mellow, we don't have to look too far to find that the Buddha himself dealt with pretty unmellow stuff. And we can continue to look for, in the Buddha's life, and with each other, and with your Dharma leaders, how is this person handling this unmellow stuff? Well, they return to resolute stability, and they have some skill at returning to resolute stability. That's part of why we work in community, so we can model for each other. One might say that our Zen meditation, this sitting in the posture, stable, clear, is a process of individual small self-discovery. We reveal to ourselves and clarify for ourselves. But it's also the collective experience of sitting side by side with each other. I would say most of all, this Zazen is an expression of deep intention. This sitting and doing nothing, we're sitting in an attitude of deep intention. And this deep intention that's both individual and collective becomes a source for being able to respond to the world with some wisdom. Indirectly, I guess I would say that the practice of seated meditation, sitting, doing nothing, gives rise to wisdom with very little effort. All we have to do is stay with it with some determination, some intention. Our practice is not a theory. It's not an idea. It's not a dogma. Although there are plenty of ideas, you know, volumes, many volumes to read that are full of ideas. But under all of that, our practice is a practical experience. Maybe bold to say this, I'm not sure. Maybe boring, I'm not sure. But we can't solely grasp our Zen practice with the mind. The human mind is too limited to actually grasp what's going on. So now we're pushed into getting this as a mind-body experience, so-called individually, but actually in truth, collectively. To the degree that our individual mind is too limited, our individual experience is also too limited. We need the collective. Zazen teaches what is possible beyond the normal realm of discursive thought. If you're willing, Mio, would you say again or read again what you said during Zazen? It's really so spot on.
The
The poem, yes.
And sitting quietly, doing nothing, spring comes and the grass grows by itself.
So there it is. Spring comes and the grass grows by itself. So it's not dogma, it's not metaphysics. And though we have ritual, Zen is really so simple. It's so simple, in fact, that it's impossible to grasp. We think of simple as, oh, I get that. But so simple becomes impossible. So this poem that Nyo has recited now tells us, just focus on posture and breathing. When necessary, as he also said, adjust your posture. This is not about toughing it out and hurting your body. When necessary, adjust your posture. Keep your back straight. And then the ego, the individual constraint of the ego, falls away all by itself. Spring comes and the grass grows. We don't often speak about our own zazen. It's a little embarrassing for me to confess to you that I'm planning my grocery list, you know, sometimes sitting here. When interacting with a teacher, sometimes it happens to me, I don't know, people will come in and say, I don't really have anything to talk with you about. I don't have an agenda right now, but they've made an appointment anyway. So I'll lean in and, so how's your zazen? And it's easier to do that one-on-one. It's not so easy to do in a more public setting. Perhaps it's self-serving of me to invite you into this so I don't feel so embarrassed about having exposed my own zazen to you. If you're willing, speak about your own experience of zazen. You know, we have these moments, the Fukan Zazengi includes it, the Dharma gate of repose and bliss. And truthfully for me, every once in a while that's true, it occurs, but mostly the mind is active. And if I focus solely on the activity of the mind, all I can think is thoughts. I'm limited by what the mind can do. It can only think. So then I'm required to focus on the rest of the experience. Anyway, if you're willing, maybe we can have a conversation about our zazen. Yeah, Max.
Yes, thanks for your confession. I'm curious also how you work with that. I don't think there's a problem with the grocery list, but there's a problem with, for me, engaging with that. So are you coming back, you know, are you, and I might be coming from a different perspective because I was also trained in Vipassana where we would say grocery list or think, you know, we make a note,
right,
and come back to the breath. So we'd actually practice a technique.
Yeah.
So are you doing something like that, or is that not in, is that a coin against actual zazen practice? Or?
There is an element of that, just to recognize, okay, thinking mind, I thought that thought. Mm-hmm. And
So that's good, right? Because then you're actually strengthening the coming back to the present, right?
Yeah. And I think of it like a body of water. Sometimes this body as a body of water is like a puddle, tiny, constrained, and sometimes it's vast and wide. So any body of water, if the wind passes over it, there are ripples on the surface, you know. So I think of the grocery list issue as just a ripple on the surface. You know? And meanwhile, something else is happening in the depths. So, long way to answer your question, Max, but I bring it back to not focusing on the ripple, but rather mm-hmm. attention on what else is currently true. Yes.
I burned these houses quite recently, the last few weeks, but I today had an interesting experience where I felt I was thinking about something, distracted, lots of activity, and then I forgot what it was, and I had this moment of, you know, when you have like a word in the tip of your tongue, or like something you just, you're trying to recover it. And I was like, wait, this is great, if I can just stay trying to recover this thing that I don't remember what it is, I won't be thinking of anything. And for about half of it, I was just in the state of feeling like I was trying to recover something, but that I knew there was really nothing. By that point, the thought had totally gone, and I was just trying to remember some activity, and it made me have no thoughts, because the difficulty became trying to have a thought that I was trying to grasp, and I had a bit of peace. I don't know if that's something people have ever felt, but it was extremely helpful for me.
That's a little bit like a popped kernel of corn.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, the way we would expect it to be isn't the way it is at all.
Exactly.
Nice. Thank you for that. There's some very direct instructions in the Fukan Zazengi for working with. If we were trying to recall a thought that has slipped by, you know, that's kind of a thing from conversation. Like if I lose track of what I was saying in the middle of a sentence, I'm going to be busy trying to remember how I was going to finish my sentence, so save ourselves some embarrassment, perhaps. But when it's your own silence in your own mind, there's now no need to recall. Yeah. So there's some very direct instruction in the Fukan Zazengi about working with the mind. Put aside all involvements and suspend all affairs. We could understand that to be to enter a monastery and give it all up. Or we can simply understand it to be to come to the Zendo and turn off your cell phone for a while. You know, for a moment, suspend all affairs. And then this. Do not think good or bad. Do not judge true or false. Give up the operations of the mind, intellect. Stop measuring thoughts, ideas, and views. Then it allows the mind to just be ripples on the surface. We don't have to think, oh, I shouldn't be thinking my grocery list, or any of the self-critical things I might do more. Stop measuring. Stop measuring. Just that much. And then, have no designs on becoming a Buddha. This is a goalless practice. Spring comes and the grass grows all by itself. And then the following line of that paragraph. How could that be limited to sitting or lying down? This is Dogen's, what I believe, humor entering this. Zazen, not limited to sitting or lying down. However, we use our seated meditation as training, and it trains the mind so that in more of the active part of our active lives, we have a different kind of response to return to. That is what I'm calling this resolute stability. Anyone else a comment about your zazen? Yes.
Yeah, I don't know. I can't really have a hard time talking about my zazen, not because I don't want to, but having the words for it.
Yes.
But I do, but something that you were just saying, which is this conflict between having something be goalless but also be a training.
Mm.
I struggle with that. That comes up at some intuitive level. I can embrace that, but when it comes to talking about it, it trips me up.
Mm-hmm.
A lot, because I find, oh, it's goalless, but then I talk about, you know, doing something that implies a goal. You're getting to a point where you're...
Mm-hmm.
And so it's something... Well, I guess I'm asking for some... If you have any thoughts on that. I guess I'm not expecting an answer, but how to not get that to trip you up in terms of talking about things.
Yeah. I think for me the analogy that comes to mind is athletic training. You know, there have been times in my life when I'm physically training to run a marathon, and it's a specific marathon, or specifically training to compete in weightlifting. You know, So there's a goal in mind, right? And that's a very specific kind of training. And then there is another kind of training, athletically for me, that is, this just is what it takes to have a well body. So I think this kind of training that I'm talking about is really just about wholesomeness and wellness. Not training for a marathon or a competition of some kind. I think it relates back to this question of Zazen is really an expression of our deepest intention. This, for the benefit of all beings. I'm training myself to be able to prevent and abandon the unwholesome states for the benefit of all beings. Like that. I think that's what I'm talking about. Mm-hmm. I think we're pretty close to 11 o'clock. Is there any other last comment?
I just want to make a comment on the translation saying.
Yes.
What is the purpose of comparing all that? Wouldn't that add extras in your in your mind, you know?
Yeah.
Could you have one or two that you've been sitting and working, and then now there are more.
Yeah.
And then when you find it stressful, and like you can't help, oh, that he or she said that, or there or here said that.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just curious, like, the more you know, the worse it gets. I mean,
I think that's a fair concern. And perhaps it's just an intellectual exercise, nothing more.
Mm-hmm.
But here's how I use the experience of comparing. I just assume that there's something I've missed. And maybe that's just my own personal way, I'm not sure.
I'm sorry, something
I've missed.
Oh.
There's something I'm not understanding. And knowing language and the function of language pretty well, there's always going to be something in an interpretation or a translation that is not exactly what the original author meant, because the translator or interpreter adds something. So by comparing multiple versions, I feel that I get a wholer picture, a more complete picture. But here's the real crux of it is, when I have multiple translations, then I must test it against my own reality. It's not that person as expert, it's not that person as expert, it's not even the original author, but is, what is that pointing at, and test it against my own reality? Where does that settle? So no, it doesn't feel stressful at all. It feels more like it feels fun in a Zen sort of a way. Yes.
If I may ask one more question.
Of course.
What is your alternative for perfect? Because every time I come to the Zendo, we chant and I say perfect Dharma, and the skeptical mind in me holds that back. I feel like, how can something be perfect? So what is your alternative for perfect?
Mm. I'm using a borrowed word that is paramitas. You might study it. For me, I feel it as living in accord with, rather than, rather than just living in accord with. So perhaps it is the same way of thinking of resolute, of moving from dissonance to consonance. And the actual physical experience for me of that is being, this sounds so Zen, I'm sorry, being in the flow, as part of the flow. Maybe this is what I'm thinking of as perfection. Thank you.